The sale of goods on the internet is booming, but the number of patent infringement lawsuits that internet retailers are now facing is on the rise as well. With websites facing millions of dollars in legal fees to defend these infringement actions, many opt instead to settle.
A good deal of these infringement actions involve non-practicing entities, often derisively called patent trolls. These patent-holding companies own business method patents, many of which were granted in the early days of the internet and contain broad language which can apply to a wide range of electronic processes.
Thomas Dustin is a patent litigator and partner with Chicago's Marshall Gerstein and Boren. He also handles cases involving e-commerce. In the LawCast Tip of the Week, Dustin joins us to offer advice on what internet companies can do to limit their liability and avoid being sued for infringement.
Can some of the patent infringement accusations that many e-tailers are now facing be traced back to the fact that when they hooked up their service, they really didn't look too deeply into the intellectual property rights surrounding the software they were using to set up the websites?
You know, I don't think that's the major problem. In this particular aspect, you have to sort of distinguish between specific features and the fundamental web technologies. A lot of these cases involve claims by patentees that they have effectively patented fundamental aspects of the way in which the internet operates. And because the internet is sort of a standards-based system, in other words, it effectively has to have some common ground rules for it to operate, you're more or less required to set up your systems in a way so that it will coordinate with other systems on the internet. And if the claims of a patent are said to read on these underlying technologies, it's not really an elective type of situation. The other issue, too, is that a lot of these patents, when they were filed, remained in the patent office for many years and then only later emerged after certain technologies had been adopted. And as a result, patentees in many of these instances benefited from the fact that technologies were adopted while their patents were working their way through the patent office, and they were then later able to claim that those technologies that now had become somewhat established were covered by their patents. The other thing that probably needs to be said is a lot of times these patents, when they're asserted, once you take a look at them, it's pretty clear that the patentees in these instances are seeking to sort of stretch what would be the plain meaning of the patent to one who would have read it back at the time that the application was filed, to stretch those claims to encompass things that were probably not within the mind of the inventor at the time. And so, as a consequence, in some of these instances, even if you had the patent and read it, you wouldn't necessarily recognize it as applying to what you're doing, per se.
So it's pretty hard to measure the value of a patented feature on a website?
The real difficulty is more with the ambiguity surrounding the rules as to how damages are to be measured. The Federal Circuit, for years, really didn't address this aspect of patent litigation by laying down some clear guidance. Only recently have they become much more active in this area. And I think it's not so much that there aren't methodologies by which one could try and measure the value of a patented feature, but the question is, which of these methodologies is the legitimate and legally appropriate way to measure and compensate in the instance of infringement? At the base level, if the feature on the website is something that the website owner has purchased or licensed from someone else, bought a piece of software to provide that feature, at one end of the spectrum, I guess, is that the price that the website owner paid to have the software necessary to operate that feature is perhaps one measure. And then on the opposite side, you have plaintiffs pressing for some measure that's based upon the total revenues earned off of a website. But obviously, websites have many, many features. Not all of them are responsible 100% for the products sold. And in fact, that analysis sort of ignores what is perhaps the most significant factor in those revenues, and that is the products themselves, which are sold by the website, are the things that generally create the demand and are the reasons why people purchase them, not so much a particular feature of the website.
Do most of the lawsuits involve patents held by non-practicing entities, so-called patent trolls? One tracking agency reports the number of suits by NPEs increased about 400% since 2001.
I don't know if there's been a really strong study done of this question specifically, but anecdotally, I can tell you that in my experience, it appears that most of these claims are being advanced by non-practicing entities, and they come in a variety of shapes and sizes. but oftentimes they're patent holding companies that have accumulated portfolios and are more or less in the business of seeking licensing fees and in lieu of that filing lawsuits.
Do you think that the large verdicts are also prompting patent holders to come out of the woodwork to file suits?
I think that years past, there was an uptick in verdicts that gained a certain amount of notoriety, and that has caused an increase in activity in the patent litigation area and has prompted sort of the advent or at least the growth of these patent holding companies and patent litigation as a business and the buying and selling of patent portfolios with the eye towards enforcing them. When you're talking about internet and e-commerce, and if you have a patent that you think covers effectively aspects of that activity, that you've got a lot of people who are doing internet and doing e-commerce. And so it's not so much a nine-figure kind of award that these plaintiffs are looking for, but they tend to work on volume in some respects so that they can take a lesser amount, but they have many more parties that they can elicit that amount from. And I think that's the model that many of these plaintiffs are following. So it's more of a volume model than a single large score, if you will.
It seems like many e-tailers hit with patent infringement suits tend to settle. Should they choose to fight rather than settle? Is this a good strategy, or does it really depend on the infringement claims?
Obviously, it helps to have a defense if you're going to defend against patent infringement suit. I think defending simply for the sake of defending may not necessarily be the best strategy. There have been a number of large e-commerce companies or internet companies who have announced as sort of a principle that they will fight these cases all the way through to trial and eventual appeals. I don't know if the facts necessarily bear out that that publicly announced strategy has had much in the way of an impact on how many times that they are named in lawsuits. Probably the more significant factor in this, frankly, is along the lines of the quote that was once attributed to Willie Sutton when he was asked why he robbed banks. He said that's where the money is. Big companies with large revenues are likely to be targets, I think, in some respects, regardless of their stated positions.
We're speaking with Tom Dustin, a partner in the Chicago-based law firm of Marshall, Gerstein and Boren, who specializes in patent litigation. Is it a good idea for companies in certain industries to band together to fight infringement suits as a group? Because usually a lot of these suits name 15, 20 companies as the defendants.
It's absolutely critical that companies cooperate with one another in these cases and, frankly, quite possibly cooperate with one another before they find themselves in these cases. I think there are opportunities for companies to band together and to share costs in challenging patents in the patent office, for example, through reexamination procedures. But certainly when they're together in litigation, I think the plaintiff's tactics oftentimes are divide and conquer. They try and create a sort of a musical chairs type of atmosphere where parties worry that they will be the one standing when the music ends. And I think if you can take away that dynamic, it certainly strengthens the defendants. And frankly, a lot of these defendants have a wealth of information about the prior art, for example. I think it's important that they share that. And the cost sharing and the division of labor can certainly allow defendants to mount a more aggressive defense than they might otherwise have been able to do individually.
What about indemnity clauses in vendor contracts regarding e-commerce technology? Is that a good line of defense, or are they really hard to negotiate and enforce?
It's more in the nature of insurance than it is a defense. It's not necessarily going to be a defense that the company who's being sued for patent infringement is going to make to the patent owner's lawsuit, but what they can do with that indemnity and defense obligation is turn around and ask a third party who bears responsibility for the accused feature or accused technology to step in and cover the cost of defense, defend the company in the event of an award, pay that award, or otherwise negotiate a settlement with the plaintiff and effectively hold that company harmless. Now, those are important clauses. The difficulty, I think, is in getting them. Companies are reluctant to provide those indemnification obligations, and it becomes kind of a matter of market size and leverage, and can you elicit that promise from the supplier or the manufacturer or vendor? Are you going to be able to do that? What's it going to cost you to get it? Is it even available? I think that a lot of these companies that produce software are sensitive in their own right to extending these indemnities. So it's a difficult area, but I think for an e-retailer, obviously, one looking at the fact that all they really do is just resell the products of others or use products of others for exactly what was intended, from their perspective, that risk really should be borne by the parties who are making that product or providing that technology.
What about the courts? Are they requiring patent holders to provide more details to support an infringement case?
Particularly in the damage area more recently, there's been an uptick in the number of Federal Circuit opinions and other opinions of courts other than the Federal Circuit that have, in some respects, made more strict the requirements for proving damages. And that's a welcome change, I think.
If you had to give advice to an online retailer setting up a website to avoid any infringement action in the future, what kind of advice would you give?
There are certain things that they're simply not going to be able to avoid. I mean, you can't know every patent that's out there, and even if you did, a lot of times you might read a patent and not consider it to apply to what you're doing. So it's certainly difficult to take stock of all of the patents that have been issued by the United States Patent Office and try and figure out which apply to you and which don't. What you can do, I think, is you can try and manage any risk. Certainly if you're having third-party supply technology for use in your website, or if you're employing third parties to build your website, or if you're interconnecting with other service offerings and having them provided through your website, I think it's important that you ensure that those parties will stand behind their products, and that if it is those products that ultimately elicit some kind of a patent infringement action, that those parties will stand behind those products and hold you harmless. I think that's probably one of the more important aspects of it, and that would probably be my first advice to a website operator.
Tom, is there something Congress could do?
Congress has been toying with this for quite a while. Maybe patent reform will have some legs this year. The fundamental problem, I think, is that whatever we get through patent reform may not necessarily do much to improve the situation, at least the particular situation that we've been discussing here. There are two constituencies in the intellectual property world that have different views on what the patent system should look like. On the one hand, the pharma and biotech industries, for whom patent protection is very important because of the long development life cycles of those products and the immense amount of money that they cost to develop, versus the e-commerce, internet, software industries, where patent protection is not used in quite the same way as the pharma and biotech industries, but they feel the brunt of the patent infringement lawsuits maybe more acutely, and so they are much more anxious to see more radical change made to the patent laws. And so you have this collision of these interest groups that may ultimately, if compromises are reached on patent reform proposals, may leave those proposals somewhat neutral and effectively not creating the kind of dramatic change that many are calling for.
Tom Dustin is a patent litigator with Marshall, Gerstein & Boren. He spoke with us by phone from his office in Chicago. Tip of the Week is a regular feature of LawCast.